This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The French Constitutional Council is expected to rule later today on special COVID-19 virus passes for all restaurants and domestic travel, while also mandating vaccinations for all health workers. Both measures have prompted protests and political tensions across France, where the country has begun dealing with a fourth wave of infections. Under the law, healthcare workers must begin getting vaccinations by September 15th or risk suspension. It also requires a health pass to enter all restaurants, trains, planes, and other public venues. To get the pass, people must either have proof they are fully vaccinated or have recently tested negative or recovered from the virus. So far, just half of the people in France are fully vaccinated. Australia's most populous state on Thursday reported its worst day of locally transmitted COVID-19 cases of the pandemic, with a record 262 new infections and 5 deaths. The Premier of New South Wales said 4 of the victims had not been vaccinated and the 5th had received a single dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine in May. As case numbers in the state continues to surge, New South Wales Chief Health Officer issued a new plea Thursday for residents to book an appointment to receive their vaccine. Only 20% of Australian adults are fully vaccinated, according to the latest government figures. And the Biden administration is moving toward requiring nearly all foreign visitors to the U.S. to be vaccinated for the coronavirus. A White House official speaking to the Associated Press said the requirement would come as part of the administration's phased approach to easing travel restrictions for foreign citizens to the country. For more news, please join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. Pope Francis resumed his routine of holding weekly audiences with the general public a month after he underwent bowel surgery. During the much-awaited appearance on Wednesday, he recalled the anniversary of the devastating Beirut port explosion and expressed the desire to someday visit Lebanon. Francis appealed to the international community to offer concrete facts of help to the Lebanese people and not just words. Francis, who was 84, was hospitalized back on July 4th in Rome for the operation during which a section of his colon was removed. Belarusian Olympic sprinter Kristina Tymanovskaya, who feared for her life at home after criticizing her coaches on social media, flew into Warsaw on Wednesday night on a humanitarian visa after leaving the Tokyo Olympics, according to a Polish diplomat. It's not clear what's next for the 24-year-old, neither in her sporting life or personal life. The International Olympic Committee is investigating what led to her being removed from the Belarus team. Her husband fled Belarus shortly after his wife said she would not be returning. Poland has also offered him a visa. Myanmar's ambassador to the United Nations, who has refused to leave his post despite being fired by the junta after the February coup, sent a letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres this week saying 40 bodies had been found in July in the Saigang area of the northwestern region of Myanmar. The junta has denied the massacre in the township of Kanai, while news agencies have not been able to independently verify the reports due to mobile networks being cut in the remote region. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the army ousted the civilian leadership back on February 1st, launching a crackdown on dissent that has killed hundreds of people. The Taliban condemned the United States Wednesday for what it described as plain interference in Afghanistan by offering to resettle Afghan civilians with affiliations to international forces who could be targeted by the insurgent group. Washington announced the program that offers thousands of Afghan interpreters, translators, along with their families, a chance to relocate as refugees in America. U.S. and NATO allies are just weeks away from winding down their military missions in the war-torn South Asian nation after 20 years. The troop withdrawal, however, has led to a record escalation in insurgent violence as the Taliban has overrun dozens of government-held districts. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, August the 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. Rivals of South Sudan's Vice President Riek Machar say that they have ousted him as the head of his party and its armed forces. They say that he's no longer representing their interests. So what does this mean for the political future of the veteran politician?
He's losing also a support base that he used to enjoy, because those generals have been the mobilizers of the fighters for Dictoriak all along.
That is Dr. James Okuk, senior fellow at the South Sudan Center for Strategic and Policy Studies in Juba, South Sudan. More with him later on in the show. And the COVID-19 global pandemic has clipped the wings of another South African airline. Low-cost Mango, a subsidiary of national carrier South African Airways, grounded its planes.
The airline industry in South Africa, together with the global industry, is facing quite a crisis. Our industry supports 470,000 jobs.
Renel Standa is the CEO of the Airlines Association of South Africa. And the Kenyan government has granted citizenship to the remaining 1,600 stateless Shona in the country. We have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, South Sudan's Vice President Riek Machar has been deposed as head of his party and its armed forces. The announcement was made by SPLM-AIO military leaders after a three-day senior leadership meeting. Machar, a veteran politician who has been one of the most influential figures in South Sudan politics, played an instrumental role in the 2018 peace deal and the formation of the current unity government. A statement by the military leaders accused Machar of undermining political reforms and nepotism. Machar's wife, Angelina Teny, serves as defense minister in the current government. Dr. James Okuk is a senior fellow at the South Sudan Center for Strategic and Policy Studies in Juba. He tells me that even though Machar's ousting has no immediate implications on his current position as vice president, it could affect his support if he decides to run for the presidency in the country's elections in 2023.
Those generals have defied Chapter 2 of the agreement for almost 2 years now. They refuse to report to the cantonment areas, and then they refuse to cooperate with the mechanism of implementation of Chapter 2 on the security arrangements. And they have been doing their own businesses, doing their own recruitment in the areas that they are controlling along the borders with Sudan.
So what does this mean for Dr. Riek Machar's support within his base and then within the army?
He's losing also a support base that he used to enjoy, because those generals have been the mobilizers of the fighters for Dictoriak all along. And they have been negotiating leverages during the Addis Ababa negotiation, even during Khartoum negotiation, even during the Kampala negotiation. They were standing firm with him, and they were a good support base and constituents for Dictoriak. Now they are leaving him. It means Dictoriak is losing a chunk of supporters and constituents that would have stood with him, and that would have given him a better political weight as he pushes his way through at the national level here.
And what kind of implications does it have on his position as vice president? Does that mean that he loses power or a diminished influence within his base?
He will not lose the power, because the arrangement for him to be the chairman of the party, which is the SPLM in opposition, it is decided by the top leadership, who he shares by himself. And this top leadership are already in Juba with him, and they are comfortable with him. The military wing are not really among the top leadership that decide the fate of the chairman of the party. So it won't be a threat to him. The other thing is, his name is inscribed in Chapter 1 of peace agreement. His name is inscribed there that he's the one to be the first vice president by name. And nobody can just replace him like that unless the agreement has to be amended.
So now that he has lost power within the military wing, or at least within a section of the military wing with all these generals, what does this mean for the future of peace in South Sudan?
Now, it means now he won't be able to wage war, because to wage war, you need generals on the ground. So if the generals are not with him, he won't wage war. But then people are in the mood of implementing the revitalized peace agreement. So nobody is in favor of war. So that's why he's comfortable. Those generals are not going even to wage war, because they will open a line of communication and negotiation with the other parts of the constituent part of the revitalized peace agreement, which we call the incumbent government of national unity. So okay. If they are talking with them and they are in peaceful terms with them, then it is not a threat, and there is not going to be war. So then Riek will be relaxed. He will not be concerned. But the effect will only come when people reach to the time of election. That's where he will feel the pinch that he has lost the constituents.
But is this fair to say that this move could embolden his arch rivals, including President Salva Kiir, who could see this as an opportunity to get rid of him?
The tricky part of this revitalized agreement is that Victor Riek is the first vice president by name. His name is inscribed in the articles of the agreement. And if President Kiir has to remove him, it means he has to go a long way of amending the agreement so that the name of Victor Riek is struck away from the agreement. That is a long route, because it needs consensus by the parties, and Victor Riek will be one of the people who will negotiate the consensus if that happens. So that's an option we are ruling out. It will not happen. They will not amend the agreement. And Kiir will not throw this agreement away, because it is the basis of his legitimacy to be the president of the republic, is this agreement. So if he throws it away, it means he has thrown his legitimacy away. And then the question of why he should continue to be the president of South Sudan will arise. So he will hold to the agreement. And holding to the agreement, it means he will keep Riek around closer to him, but will weaken him for the coming election. That is what he can do. And weaken his base by making his supporters to defect. And that will make him to be powerless when the election come, and he will lose the election terribly if he decide to run for the coming election.
That is Dr. James Okuk, senior fellow at the South Sudan Center for Strategic and Policy Studies. This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Doctors Without Borders, MSF, has been forced to withdraw its services from Northwest Cameroon, where the ongoing armed violence between security forces and armed separatists continue to harm the population and their ability to access healthcare. Scott Hamilton is a communications officer for MSF in Cameroon. He spoke to Ricky Shryock about the development and the impact it will have on the community.
For us, I think the impact has been ongoing, and we've seen it through some former patients and through some of our contacts in the community. Last year, in 2020, we treated more than 40,000 people. We conducted more than 40,000 consultations, things like women in labor, treated people for sexual violence, children for malaria, for diarrhea, and so on. So quite a range of things. And we did more than 4,000 ambulance referrals. So we already know that over the last 8 months, there's been an impact. Our ambulance call center the phone has continued to ring even though we've been under suspension. So we know that this is having an impact on the population, and we know that many people can't afford the healthcare services that are currently in place, that many people can't even reach the centers providing that healthcare.
And you said the phones are continuing to ring for the ambulance services. Do you guys have numbers on how many calls you get a day? That would be quite difficult, obviously, for people in the community to make these calls and to find out that there are no ambulances coming, basically.
I don't have that data to hand in terms of how many people are calling per day. And of course, now we've scaled down, so we're not actually, there's no one manning the phones anymore. The phones don't exist now because we've been forced to scale down. But I mean, what I can tell you a little bit about it is when the ambulance service was functioning, we saw a big spike in the number of calls that we received every Monday, and that's when there's a lockdown day, so nobody can leave their homes, even if it's for emergency medical care. And our ambulances were able to move during those days. You know, we know that there will be an increased need if there are no other emergency transport services for people.
Monday is a lockdown day due to the ongoing issues in the region or due to COVID?
Due to the ongoing issues. So since the crisis in the northwest and southwest regions began, there have been a number of lockdowns and curfews. Every Monday, there's what's called a ghost town day. That's where nobody is essentially allowed to leave their homes. It's an imposed kind of curfew every Monday. So thankfully, our ambulances, when they were in operation in the northwest, were able to move on Mondays. That was because our modus operandi was well understood by everybody, that, you know, we provide medical care free of any kind of agenda. And unfortunately now, of course, that service is no longer running.
What is MSF hoping in the near future can happen in terms of getting back to treating this population?
Well, as I say, we retain a small liaison office in Bamenda with the aim of continuing to advocate for the health needs of the population in the Northwest and to follow some of the health trends that are ongoing. But it is a really difficult situation. I mean, when you look at the numbers, when you look at the needs of the population and the level of violence in this ongoing crisis, from our perspective, it's clear that someone else needs to come forward and to fill the gap that's left by MSF. Whether that's the Ministry of Health or another organization, you know, someone needs to provide free or affordable healthcare for the population and, you know, to make healthcare services available to people.
This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. South Africa-based Aspen Pharmacare, the largest drug manufacturing company in Africa, is hoping to conclude a deal it says could flood the continent with hundreds of millions of COVID-19 vaccines in months to come. Darren Taylor reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
The Johnson & Johnson jab is particularly important in Africa's battle to stop the spread of COVID-19 because it's the only single-shot vaccine and it can be stored at normal fridge temperatures where power outages are commonplace. Aspen doesn't make the shots from scratch because it doesn't yet have the technology to do so. It imports the main ingredient, mixes it with a buffer solution, and packages it. Aspen's current contract with J&J means the vaccines that roll off the company's lines often end up in Europe or wherever else J&J decides. Aspen's CEO, Stephen Sard, says his firm wants J&J to give it an ownership license to benefit the entire continent.
And the advantage of that, you release your product, you determine who gets supply of your product. And so if you want to say, I want to give 100% to Africa or to South Africa, you have complete control over that process.
Sard says his company is currently making 25 million vaccines a month. That's 300 million a year. But within 2 years, it hopes to have capacity to ship 1 billion jabs to African Union nations. J&J has indicated it's considering Aspen's proposal. However, the head of African Vaccine Equity Group, the Health Justice Initiative, Fatima Hassan, says Aspen shouldn't be the only pharmaceutical firm on the continent with an ownership license.
You need many Aspens, and there are certainly at least 5 other companies in Africa that should be given a full license from Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson should not be determining which companies, when, how many supplies. We really need billions of vaccines before the end of 2021.
The health and human rights lawyer says it's dangerous to rely on just one firm to make what could be Africa's game-changer vaccine.
You need to have many more suppliers so that you can actually safeguard the supply chain. Because if you have, for example, a fire at the plant of Aspen, or you have a contamination, you basically affect the entire supply chain, not just for South Africa's vaccine program, but for the whole of Africa.
Hassan says J&J should also share how to make the active pharmaceutical ingredient, or API, its so-called vaccine recipe, with African drug manufacturers as soon as possible. Pharmacologist and World Health Organization medicines advisor Andy Gray agrees especially because COVID-19 vaccines were developed mostly with public money.
Locking it up within the intellectual property of one for-profit company just does not seem the right thing to do. That's a technology agnostic position.
Pharmaceutical multinationals argue that full technology transfer would take years and so wouldn't help to end the pandemic. Gray's response is, so what?
I think there is also within the activist community a recognition that these are complex procedures and that the technology is going to be difficult to transfer and that the timelines are not going to be as short as we would like them to be. But there's also a recognition that this is a very convenient excuse.
Gray says the sooner Africa's empowered with the infrastructure, technology and skills to enable it to make vaccines from scratch, the better, so that when the next pandemic hits, it's able to avoid the shortages of jabs that he says are in great part to blame for the COVID-19 deaths on the continent so far. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And still in South Africa, COVID-19 has clipped the wings of another South African airline. Low-cost Mango, a subsidiary of national carrier South African Airways, grounded its planes without notice last week after failing to pay for air traffic control services. With the backing of the unions, employees have filed court papers to get the airline into a business rescue arrangement. Industry experts say that it is survival of the fittest right now in the airline industry. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Mango is the latest on the list of South African carriers that have succumbed to the economic impact of COVID-19. The airline announced suspension of all flights till further notice, citing its failure to pay for air traffic navigation services. 3 months ago, the airline temporarily grounded its fleet after failing to pay the Airports Company of South Africa. Mango's parent company, South African Airways SAA, has been undergoing a year-long business rescue and has yet to return to the skies. The government paid an initial $736 million to SAA to come out of business rescue, but is yet to pay an additional $189 million, which was partly expected to bail out Mango. Mango's operating profits declined from $33 million in the year ending 2020 to an operating loss of $11 million. Renel Stander, CEO of the Airlines Association of Southern Africa, says COVID-19 travel restrictions for inbound, outbound and local travel are likely to blame.
The airline industry in South Africa, together with the global industry, is facing quite a crisis. Our industry supports 470,000 jobs indirectly and 70,000 jobs directly. So it really is critical.
But aviation analyst Puteho Mojapele also blames mismanagement, which has been long hampering state-owned enterprises.
The running costs of Mango are not that much. So it would have been really make sense for them to just put a lot of energy on creating Mango to be something that SAA can rely on when they're trying to sort themselves out. They've just been sleeping on the job.
But workers and the unions blame the government for not being willing to rescue the airline as the largest shareholder in the South African Airways. Phakamile Shubima-Jola says they have approached the court to force management to stop dragging its feet in putting Mango under business rescue. This, she says, could save up to 740 jobs at the airline.
We actually feel that whilst government might claim that it is interested in business rescue for Mango, its actions do not reflect this. And the ultimate goal will be that Mango will be wound down because there is no political will to save it.
The government denies it. Comair, another South African airline, suspended flights in June, citing viability challenges under current travel restrictions. And Stander says getting back in the air will be challenging.
Those airlines that have reduced the costs and that have got access to funding, I think those are the airlines, you know, that will survive.
Currently, South Africa allows travel within in and out of the country under strict COVID regulations, but air travel has been shut down during the worst of the waves of infections, and most citizens have lost their jobs and can't afford flights. The aviation industry contributes over $10 billion per year to the South African economy. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And as we end the show, let's go to East Africa in Kenya, where the government has granted citizenship to the remaining 1,600 stateless Shona in the country, decades after their ancestors immigrated to the country. The ethnic Shona, who have been struggling for rights and benefits, are celebrating their new status. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
With a spring in her step and identification in hand, Sheba Mungani makes her way to withdraw money sent by a customer from an agent for M-Pesa, a mobile phone-based money transfer service. For more than 20 years, Mungani has been weaving baskets to earn a living. Access to financial credit through banks and other financial services has been a major stumbling block for her and other women from her community. Mungani is Shona. Her community has been pushing for recognition from the Kenyan government for decades. Members of the Shona community were recognized as citizens of Kenya only recently. She says before getting the legal status of citizenship and an ID, it was really tough. When there is an employment opportunity and people go without an ID, they miss out on getting a chance. She says her telephone lines would be registered by third parties who at times were not honest in terms of remitting all the money that was due, she said. Around 1,600 Shona community members were symbolically given identification cards to mark the Shona's community formal recognition as Kenyans. The Shona immigrated to Kenya around 50 years ago as missionaries at the invitation of the country's founding president, coming from Zimbabwe and Zambia. Nosizi Ndube is one of the lucky few Shona who have had a chance to further their education. She is an economics student at the University of Nairobi. In between helping Mungani, her aunt, sell basketware, Ndube takes breaks to study. With the change of legal status, Ndube says she is now hopeful of scaling even greater heights.
Actually, it feels very fine and very great right now to be able to access my formal education with no challenges and formal employment also, and to be able to travel abroad to accomplish further studies, yeah.
Robert Waweru is with the Kenya Human Rights Commission, an independent civil rights organization that advocates for human rights and democratic reforms. His group and other advocacy organizations say the Shona still face challenges even when opportunities are granted.
It will take years for them to catch up with the rest of the country in terms of their literacy level. They have not been able to go to school for all those years for lack of documentation. Socioeconomically, they lag behind because they exist on the fringes of the economy. It will take a longer time for them to integrate into the mainstream economy.
According to United Nations human rights officials, about 715,000 stateless people live in Africa. With citizenship now given to the Shona, they effectively become Kenya's 45th tribe. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, August the 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day ahead, Africa.
Of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.